expertise surrounding the use of that facility, and we provide the expertise in the design construction mode. It's not clear to me that the other executive branches would want to RSA their monies to an independent commission that was not part of the executive branch and was not responsive to the kind of client supportive relationships that currently exist. And we would then be stuck with the question of what the residual scope of the department, where that's going to reside. Is still continue as a separate department or reside in another department? And the loss of the economies of scale in terms of using those same skills. I guess finally, Mr. Chairman, outside of the realm of policy, specific to just where we stand in the history of this state with regards to this department has gone through quite a bit of change in the last few years. And of course, we've introduced quite a bit of organizational change in the last few months. And that process is continuing. I'm concerned that in talking to people who have been around for quite some time, legislators and administrators and just observers of state government here, that one of the things this department needs a lot is a consistent game plan, and one in which the management can take a few years to work out that game plan. It gets to a point where change becomes more destructive even than the philosophical substance behind the intent of that change.
Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just so I'm clear now, your position on the bill is what?
Well, we're opposed to the bill.
You're opposed to the bill.
Okay.
I wasn't.
I apologize if I didn't make myself clear.
Well, I wasn't sure whether you had not. Are you familiar with House Bill 68, which just passed the House, which creates the Alaska Marine Highway Authority?
Yes, Representative, I am very familiar with it.
Do you see any conflict between that piece of legislation and the duties and authorities given to that authority and creation of this board? Let me read you an example, and I'm wondering if perhaps the Transportation Committee has looked at this or others, or if you have. One of the powers of the authority of the Alaska Marine Highway Authority, which we just established, is to operate, maintain, improve, and extend a system of ferries connecting with the public roads and highways of the state, and including the boats, vessels, docks, approaches, etc. One of the duties of this board is to manage, operate, and maintain state transportation facilities, communication facilities, and all docks, floats, breakwaters, and buildings, including state highways, vessels, railroads. So who's in charge of the marine highways after this bill passes and this one passes?
Well, Representative Duncan, I hope you're not the bellwether for what's going to happen to either one of these bills.
Well, I want you to know I voted against 68 and not very enthused about this one at this moment. But I'm wondering, do you see a possible conflict between this board that's being created and the authority that was just recently created?
Well, yes.
Or being proposed in 68.
Very clearly. You know, honestly, with some attention, the degree of overlap that exists now between the two bills could be sorted out. We do have what, you know, the buzzword in the department is intermodal coordination. We have questions about whether or not we should build a road south of Sitka and not have to run the ferry as far in, or somebody that proposes a road and we ask whether or not it's more efficient to schedule a ferry in substitution for the cost of the road. And with two separate groups, a marine highway system and a transportation group, you're going to have some different agendas as to which the best mode is to serve a particular community. At least the degree of overlap that you point out, which is obviously confusing at this juncture, would be something that would have to be worked on.
Mr. Chair, I guess my point is that if the legislature is serious about doing this, we should work out that disagreement before we pass the legislation. And I would hope that if this bill is going to move, we would look at that, because we very clearly, in the bill that passed the House this morning, gave the power to operate and maintain vessels, state ferry systems, that authority, and very clearly in this legislation, we're giving the authority to manage, operate, and maintain state vessels to this board, and there's a tremendous conflict there, I think. And I surely don't want to see the legislature passing legislation where we've given that power to two separate boards and then say, Commissioner, you resolve the difference. One, it couldn't, right? It would be charged with statute to do it. So I think this bill legislation should be very carefully reviewed as to what was done in 68.
Commissioner, you mentioned in your topic a game plan, continuity of a game plan, I believe is the word you use, by keeping it under the commissioner. But one of the things that we have is the changes of commissioners every 4 years. You guys are only going to be around maybe less than 4 years, you know, in the fashion you're going today and this administration. But a board is going to be along with staggered terms, going to be along for a long time, and they'll have a future of the game plan. You see, we lose continuity when we change commissioners because we come on with different philosophies and different ideas. And I disagree with perhaps what you say your game plan is. And so I just want you to know that I think perhaps the authority is the best way to go, because the boards are on staggering terms and they're on there for a while. Are you going to be around, you know, if the next governor, whoever that is elected, say that's what?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might, the arguments against this bill, I did not mean to imply, were predicated on a particular personality or a particular commissioner. What I meant to say is that regardless of this particular administration or the fact that election occurred in November, this department had already gone and is now going under a lot of change. In terms of your question of whether or not you get continuity on the board or not, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I would have to dispute that strongly, and I guess the people who debated that issue in forming the Constitution of the state found that, and several of the states have subsequently found it, and we're now finding it in several other boards and commissions in the state. And that is that while you have a continuity of commissioners on a particular board, by virtue of the type of role they fill, they don't control the organization nearly as much as a commissioner that has to come before this body and before a governor and is subjected to the checks and balances of periodic elections. There are some risks in the lack of continuity in terms of periodic elections, but the benefit is that, by gosh, it has to be more responsive and accountable. The advantage of a standalone commission for transportation, as exercised in all the other states in the union and is starkly different from this one, is that they submit 6-year capital plans, get endorsement by the legislature in policy, are excluded from the legislative requirements that prohibit more than 1 year's worth of commitments. And so they get game plans going, but the risk is they are highly independent of responsiveness to the executive branch and the legislature. There are trade-offs here. And when you have an authority that can stand, or a commission that can stand its own 2 feet financially, and you desire to sever it from the executive branch to make it accountable for meeting its income and outgo, and let it have the flexibility to become be able to pursue, a long-term 6-year capital plan, either existing Department of Transportation can do that, or a separate commission can do that. But in the absence of the legislature relinquishing its ability to review the appropriation or allocations for the department on an annual basis, it's not clear to me that you're going to have any more or less consistency capabilities. And the fear is that with the commission, you're going to have a lot less accountability.
Thank you. Representative Martin and Lindahl.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Duncan hit the main thing I was really concerned about, and that is House Bill 68 being passed by, and I kind of think I had an open mind in trying that one as a step forward in trying to solve many of our transportation problems. But with this one right behind it, it just scares the heck out of me, and especially with the representatives showing the conflict that the different boards and the commission are going to have. One of the problems I have with it is not only that, but I kind of support what Mr. Casey says. And it seems to me that the legislative and executive were giving our powers away. But I want to use that as an example. One of the problems that we've had is a Alaska Transportation Commission. The legislators for years have been trying to get rid of that thing one way or the other, and they never succeed to. I'm also worried about the regional jurisdictions that they'll have here, where one part of the commission in Northwest wants the road to go one way, and maybe the central area wants the road to go the other way, and they'll never meet each other. There's an imaginary boundary there. And I really think if you put this in subcommittee number one, I don't want to be on it.
What's your question, Martin? You say you do or you don't?
Well, I think, like Representative Dunder, this is too much. My question is to the administrator, to the sponsor, if I may. Have you guys discussed the two differences in the bills? It's just obviously gross conflicts with your Marine Highway Commission and this board. What was the sponsor's point of view?
Well, the bill was established all at the same time, however, recognizing that the deal was such a subject and that there's no guarantee assurance that our money can be all of the bills in that package are going to pass, but the individual bills have to be assigned so they stand alone.
The way it's still.
Representative Lindauer?
Chairman, I find myself in agreement with Representative Martin, so I'm not sure where I've gone wrong here. But
I'm in agreement with you.
So I'm not sure that I've gone doing the right thing. But
uh-oh, what's going on here?
However, I will. I share the same concerns about going too much. I think we have a situation here, and I think the commissioner probably will agree that the built-up frustration of the legislature and the people of this state not only helped elect this governor, but simultaneously have resulted in people really no longer waiting for more promises after idle years and many promises. And I think that's why we passed, and I voted for, the Marine Highway Authority. I think I have a very open mind on this. I am not committed to this. But before I make up my mind, I need to have you tell me what you think of combining transportation, which I see road building and related things, airports and so forth, but I understand it's not just roads, and public facilities, which appear to be very, very different. So how you operate or build a building someplace, public facilities, is just a little bit different than planning a road. And does it make sense if we're going to have a commission and start splitting these things off that instead of having a commission over all of transportation, that maybe we should get rid of our so-called transportation commission, as somebody mentioned, that maybe we should have a separate public works or public facilities commission, that maybe there should be an organizational look that would split this apart in some fashion or eliminate that commission or your. Maybe you should assume some of the duties of that commission and split off the public facilities. What do you think you ought to do?
Well, Representative Lindauer, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lindauer, I must confess that I hadn't confronted that issue seriously. Maybe I ought to. In terms of the question of the similarities or dissimilarities between the construction of public facilities and others and transportation facilities. In fact, there is a lot of precedent in the private sector for combining those functions. As regards to the issue of constructing those facilities, and that's because that true, there are different kinds of engineering consideration in the design of a road from that of construction of a bridge or a dock or an office building or a prison. But those differences are at fairly low technical levels in the organization. And mostly reside in the contract
design people that you retain. The similarities occur in terms of permitting, EISing, client user requirements, budgeting, budgeting control, contracting, both design and construction, the quality assurance functions. There are a lot of similarities when you build a building with a lot of the basics you use in a road, even at the technical level, in terms of the geotechnical work that you have to do as you start the process. You can split those off. It's a matter of economies of scale in terms of how much in the way of facility construction a department has, and where, if that was separated, you might get duplicate kinds of talents and efforts that you otherwise wouldn't need if you could commingle it with the kinds of drafting, contracting, financial controls, public hearings, whatnot skills that already reside in another department that has to have it for transportation facilities. In this era of declining budgets, and Mr. Chairman, you know, this administration, this commissioner is committed to declining organizational sizes, we're seeing a tremendous collapsing within the department as currently configured in the commingling of what used to be 4 years ago separate divisions, which are now in the design side only separate design groups that are even being commingling below the design group phase on the design side into common talents to service across many disparate types of facilities.
Mr. Chairman, I have two more questions. One, what is your relationship to the Transportation Commission, and what do you propose to do about it in the sense of either phasing them out, bring them under your control, or how useful?
You're talking about
Alaska
Transportation.
Yeah, the Alaska Transportation. Now, you're the Commissioner of Transportation. I would assume that the Alaska Transportation Commission, you ought to have some relationship to it.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Lindauer, as you may be aware or may not be aware, the Alaska Transportation Commission resides statutorily under the Department of Commerce and not under the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. We do have some involvement. And we have teamed up with Commissioner Lyon in the lead and Commissioner Sundberg to look at the question of the ongoing function of the commission. This department plays a role and has a lot of awareness of uses of rural airports as it relates to comments on essential air service. We have teamed up with the Department of Commerce and Public Safety looking at questions of safety enforcement by the line organizations in contrast to safety enforcement by the Alaska Transportation Commission.
That's not my question. My question really is a more fundamental one, and that is, do you plan to try to bring them under your, or recommend to bring them under your administration, or do you plan to recommend that they be done away with? They are in transportation. You're in transportation. It seems to me we're talking about a transportation commission. Maybe we should just bring you under them or them under you. How many transportation commissions do we propose to have?
Well, the Transportation Commission, as you know, was basically set up for economic regulation and not the execution of projects or the operation of services. If you continue to economically regulate an industry in terms of rate hearings and findings of need of service, that's a separate kind of set of skills. It could be combined, but it is a separate kind of set of skills in terms of hearing officers and review boards and findings of fact and economic analysis of the pricing structure that somebody is proposing or contesting is a lot different than what it takes to run a service or build a facility. In fact, the administration's position on the ATC in particular is, let's extend it for an intermediate period of time to give us some time to work out the questions of the functions, the need for the functions, and where they might reside.
I have one more question, Mr. Chairman. I, as members of this committee know, I've expressed to the legislature and reported I have a conflict of interest in that I have waterfront property, and I did notice that on my desk today there was a financing or subsidizing through appropriations private business.
If I might, Representative Linder, I presume that you're alluding to possibly a project in South Central Seward. Well, constitutionally, as well as, of course, policy and statutorily, if a facility is only anticipated for private industrial use and for single purpose, that is one company, then the answer's got to be no, it's not the position of the state to extend public facilities for such a project. What we're finding, and I might add not only with this facility, but we're finding in the case of several road projects in conjunction with mining development, is that you frequently have a transportation facility, a dock, a road, a port, an airport, that through a leading industrial developer can be leveraged through revenue bonds to be developed and justified in, alternatively, in the absence of having come to the general fund and just 100% general fund. But a reasonable case can be argued that that is they first industrial user over the cycle of a particular road or port or airport, and that will lead to other users, other mines, or whatnot.
If I might interrupt you and clarify my question a little more, I noticed in the description of the materials and being familiar somewhat with that project that you really had two parts to it. You had a port part, which would be the general use part that you just described and so forth. But there was also very product-specific, actually contract-specific equipment, which you may well legitimately wish to do. I don't know how I'd vote on that. I think I might, in a narrow sense, favor you doing that than expect you to do it for me and every other builder of any kind. Provide everybody with equipment would be my motto.
Well,
I'd like to know what your view of the principle is.
Okay. This sounds fine. First of all, if the state invested any money through sponsoring some sort of state financing vehicle or from the general fund, I think the prerequisite is that facility has to be positioned and available for all comers. I mean, that's got to be part of it. That's not disputed. At least from an administration point of view, on this specific project, and in general in terms of the work we're doing on things like HB 151, 377, as it relates to other types of projects like that. In specific, the hardware, for example, we're talking about the loading arm and the conveyor, has got to be viewed as being available to service. The reasonable argument has to be made that other types of materials, such as grain, gravel, or other coal exporters, are going to have to be used, have to be able to use that kind of hardware, or again, you're right, we shouldn't be having to finance and purchase that hardware. If the hardware...
So you're always asking that, if I have to change the documents that suggest that that's going to be operated by one company. If that's the case, I'd like to, I'll send you my blueprint and I expect you to build mine too.
Thank you. Representative Ward?
Yeah, mine's just kind of a technical question, and I'm not sure who can answer. I just don't understand it. But anyway, it says on page 4, it says, supervise and maintain all state automotive and mechanical equipment, aircraft and vessels, except aircraft and vessels used by the Department of Fish and Game or the Department of Public Safety. My question is does the Alaska National Guard, maybe barring the adjutant general's car, but are those trucks and stuff, are those owned by the state? And if so, they got their own motor pool. See, are these owned by the state, military affairs? Are those vehicles owned by the state of Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I don't know the answer to that question.
I don't either.
And we have to get that answer. I'm sure we can get it very quickly.
Because they do have quite a few, and it'd be... They are?
Okay. Probably National Guard.
All right, I didn't know.
Very good, Ben.
Representative Duncan. Thank you very much. Representative Zaro.
Thank you. Chairman. I was, it's been a while, but I think I was going to concur with Representative Martin's comments 100%.
What was his suggestion?
It was something about a subcommittee, I'm not quite sure, but that was part of it as well. But Mr. Chairman, the I'm sure that the bill has had a considerable amount of testimony in the Transportation Committee. Can we have the Transportation Committee report read?
Representative Zaro, before we have it read, did you wish your subcommittee on this bill?
Did I?
Yeah.
No, I was conferring with Representative Martin.
Me too.
But quickly they dropped.
Simon Dukas, Cato, other recommendations, neither all, no recommendation. Zemanski, Abood, Miller, Herman, Phillips, and Lasker. Lasker?
Yeah.
Lasker.
That's the board.
Representative Zaro, you still have.
No, that was it. I was just wondering in the committee report. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Appreciate it. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill number 69? Does any of the members have any comments or recommendations, Representative Grusendorf?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's been some concern here that we passed out of the House a particular piece of legislation that deals with the marine transportation system. But at the same time, it is a piece of legislation that's going through the process. And I think any recommendations to take parts of a total package for transportation out of this would cause problems for us should that particular piece have passed the House fail. And I think we're talking about a process which will have to jive our interests with the other body. And I would be hesitant about striking out or making any changes in relation to this dealing with the marine transportation system until we know what we actually are dealing with in the final analysis.
Your recommendation to hold it in committee, Representative?
No, that's not necessarily my recommendation, Mr. Chairman. I'm just saying that some people have indicated that, hey, isn't this a duplication of effort? But at the same time, if we take it out here, then we're sending a partial thing over should the marine transportation bill fail.
Okay. Representative Lindauer?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that we hold this in the committee until we see, hold this in the committee until we see the final disposition of the port of the Marine Highway Authority bill, which directly impacts this legislation.
Thank you, Ripson. Did you move it?
I moved it.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Your request granted.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chairman, instead of just holding it, shouldn't we, I assume that Steve will be working with some of the details.
That's fine.
Yeah. The last bill we got this afternoon is Committee Substitute for House Bill number 94, Judiciary. This is sponsored by Bettis, Wirth, and Grusendorf.
Oh,
and it's
God.
An act relating to the seizure of items used in the aid of fish and game violations. This bill changes the law relating to seizures of items involved in fish and game violations. It provides that seizure is only allowed if needed for evidence or if there is a chance that the item will be removed from the area. It also provides that the owner of the item can get it back if needed for his livelihood unless the court determines within 7 days that the item will be removed from the area if returned. There was a $173,900 fiscal note. Now it's changed to zero, which was passed around earlier from Department of, the one that I've got is from Public Safety. And we've got here to testify as somebody from the Department of Law. Is it Dale?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dale Horetsky, and I'm from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. As I think you're probably aware, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Law, and especially the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, are not in favor of this bill. We have a fiscal note, I have the most recent one that I have, which is dated May 19th, which shows a estimated fiscal impact of $173,000 the first year, and then it goes up slightly, I believe, to allow for inflation in succeeding years. Our objection to it is not based so much on the fiscal impact, although that's certainly one of the things I mentioned in my memo to you, sir, but it is basically that, in our opinion, the bill as currently drafted would seriously hamper enforcement efforts. There are, Mr. Chairman, if I may ask the committee's indulgence, there are two ways now, two general ways under which items are seized if they're used in fish and game violations. And if I could briefly explain what those are. If a person has a big item, such as a ship or a plane, that is being used in a violation, like a commercial fishing violation or a guiding violation, often the officers will go to the Department of Law, generally the Civil Division, and will request a seizure warrant to seize that vessel or to impound that airplane. And that is actually passed on by a judge after he hears testimony and cross-examination and then issues a warrant, the same way it would be like a search warrant or an arrest warrant. And then the fish and game officers, armed with this warrant, go out and seize the vessel and impound it for these violations. The other way that items are sometimes seized, and this is generally in the case of smaller items, is the officers out patrolling on the Kenai River or wherever he's supposed to be, and he sees somebody committing a fish and game violation and walks up to that person and writes them a ticket or a citation for over-limit salmon, for example, or the use of the wrong kind of fishing gear. He hands the person the ticket, which says appear in court in 10 days, and he takes the person's fishing rod and puts it in evidence. Those are the two ways that the state takes possession of fish and game items, items used in violation of fish and game law. As I understand this proposed amendment, sir, it would require that all items seized, regardless of value, size, seriousness of the offense, anything like that, that all items seized would be automatically returned to the offender unless there's a court order issued within 7 days, which indicates that the state can keep the item. And I note in my letter to Chairman Bussell, which I gave to you, Mr. Chairman, as an attachment, that in some areas of the state where items are seized, such as on the Aleutian Chain or in some places in the interior, there are fish and wildlife officers there to enforce the law, especially on perhaps a seasonal basis, but we do not customarily have Department of Law representatives, either civil or criminal, no DAs, available in that town. There usually won't be a judge there either. There may be a magistrate in the general area, but there won't be like a superior court judge or a district court judge often. What that means is the officer is able to file the charges, so that clock starts ticking, that 7-day clock, but the DA doesn't know anything about it or the AG doesn't know anything about it unless they get a phone call from the officer that our 7 days are running. That puts us in a position of us, the Department of Law, of determining whether to go ahead and lose that possession of that item automatically on the 7th day or to try to run around and get a hearing set up either by phone, which probably would be the preferable measure, or by actually physically flying both a DA and a judge out there to have a hearing in Cold Bay or Naknek or some of these places to determine if we can keep possession of this item, which we need for evidence. That's a serious problem, in our opinion, and it's going to cost a lot of money whichever way we decide to do it. If there is a judge available and you go ahead and have your hearing, then the judge has to make the determination, one, if it's evidence, or two, if it's going to be taken out of the jurisdiction. That would remove the court's ability to keep an item for other reasons for which we can currently seize items, and that is deterrence. General deterrence, if a person knows his plane is on the line, hopefully he's less likely to violate the law. Secondly, that at least during the time that that vehicle or that vessel or that gear is impounded in an evidence locker, an impound lot, it's not being used for continual violations of the law, especially during like a fishing season or a hunting season. This might be important. The Supreme Court of the state, in some case decisions, which I cite in my letter to Chairman Bussell, has specifically recognized that deterrence of others and prevention of the continued use of that item in law violations is a legitimate state purpose which would allow, under current law, the state to keep an item or else to request a person post a bond. In big item cases like vessels or planes, usually in hazard to guess, 85 to 90% of the cases involving big items, the owner is able to come in and say, okay, you know, without making a statement about you caught me dead to rights, without admitting any liability, let me post this bond and get my boat back, okay? And AGs, customarily, they have forms that they use to draw these things up, and if they post the bond, we give them the plane back. And one of the requirements of posting the bond and signing the paper is that the offender, accused offender, he's not yet been convicted because the trial is weeks away at least, signs a piece of paper that says, I promise I won't continue to use this boat in violation of the law. So if he does and you catch him again, you've got sort of another thing to point to. And at the very least, if he sells the plane or takes it out of state, you've got his bond, which he posted to get the thing returned to you. I understand that some of the reasons that prompted this bill were that some people were getting things seized, like a plane or a boat seized, and there might be an innocent security interest, who might not have been using the item illegally, but his partner was, or this is a company and only one, the captain is responsible for the violation or something of that sort. And I hope that I was able to address that concern in, again, the letter that I sent, which indicates that under current law, and there are two main cases, State v. Rice and FV American Eagle versus State, the state is required to allow innocent third parties who have security interests in a vessel or an item of that sort to basically get the item returned to them, to have a hearing where they can argue, listen, it wasn't my fault this guy broke the law, let me have the plane back. There are not, right now, specific words in the statute which embody that procedure, but we are required to go through that procedure by these case decisions, and in fact, the Attorney General's office does commonly go to hearings of that sort to allow innocent third parties to get back their interest in a certain item. Basically, the bottom line is, in our opinion, current law works well, that there are provisions in it which allow innocent parties to get remission if that's appropriate, that there are several reasons why we want to seize a plane in addition for use of as evidence, and that this bill removes our ability to seize those items. And even if we do seize it, number one, for evidence, or number two, to keep it from being moved out of the state, we automatically lose it in 7 days unless we go through this rigmarole of a hearing and notice and all that sort of thing. So, are there any questions?
Yes, Representative Ward.
Yes, thank you. Can you tell me how many boats were seized last year, and then can you tell me how many automobiles and how many airplanes?
No, sir. I could try to get that information.
Okay. Well, I think I already know. Do you know how many fishing poles were seized?
Fishing poles?
Fishing poles.
I would guess a couple hundred, but that's just based on my experience as a prosecutor in the Anchorage area. Fishing game violations I'm familiar with.
I'm not so sure, but I don't have a boat. But shouldn't I, with a fishing boat? Fishing pole be treated the same as a commercial fisherman?
Mr. Chairman, I think, Representative Ward, that the interests of a person in, like, fishing rod or tackle box are a little less compelling than a person who owns a crab boat upon which he depends for his livelihood, and maybe you're right in the middle of crab season, out in the harbor or something.
How about a 25,000 net then?
That's sort of in the middle.
No, that's right up there with the boats.
If the concern is that a person is going to lose his or her
livelihood. No, I'm just saying about treating equally.
Oh, okay. Well, for your information, sir, the Resources Committee version of this bill had a $2,500 limit, and they said, basically it said, the state can keep everything under $2,500 if it's needed for evidence. But if it's above $2,500, then they kicked in that got to return it within 7 days and less. So that somebody who had a boat or a plane would be able to request a hearing within, to be held within 7 days, or else they would get it back. And I think, I'm not sure what the sponsors or the committee's reasoning on that was, but I think it was a person's interest in an item that is worth $2,500 is likely to be more substantial and more pressing than an interest in a fishing rod or traps or something, where the individual value is much less. Does that answer your question?
Well, it answers it. I don't agree with it, but it answers.
Well, that $2,500 limit was taken out in judiciary, so that now the bill applies to everything.
As I catch your entire conversation, which I don't pretend to have got all of it, it seems to me you kept categorizing little set nets and stuff like this, and our big concern is fishing boats and things like that. We're talking about seizure, and so
Right. There
should be a clear policy for all of it, shouldn't there?
Yes, sir, and there is under current law.
Although some of them can bond, and you can't bond for a fishing pole.
Well, you could bond for a fishing pole. So far as I know, nobody's ever come in and said.
Can you bond for a fishing net?
Yes, sir, you can put a bond up for anything. But it's only when you're talking about big, expensive items that the people care enough to come in and put up a bond.
Can you bond currently for this here? This is a... Can you bond for a game?
To receive the game back?
Uh-huh.
No, I don't believe so, because game is automatically forfeited if the person is convicted, whereas a boat or a plane or even the net is forfeitable within the court's discretion, even if the person is convicted. In other words, they might find you guilty, but they think taking your plane away is too stiff, so the court decides not to do it, although the court could. But if we're talking about salmon or moose or game parts, those are automatically forfeited under statute if the person is convicted. So it's not up to the court.
Oh, they're forfeited before they're convicted.
Well, they are seized,
yeah.
Sure, and then held in evidence in a refrigerator until the court decides what to do with the case. And then if the person is convicted, they are automatically forfeited to the state. If the person is found not guilty, the parts are returned to him.
You're sure it works that way?
I'll tell you what the law says. Yes. Now, if there are individual officers who may have violated department policy or something like it, individual cases, I can't swear that that's never happened. So far as I'm aware, that is the way it works, and that is the way it is supposed to work.
Okay. Captain Grusendorf?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not necessarily satisfied with what the Judiciary Committee came out in the form of a committee substitute. I prefer to look at the Resources Committee version of that particular bill. And on lines 14, 15, and 16, what the prime sponsor and I as the co-sponsor were trying to get at and have been for several years is that we wanted the person out in the field to make certain judgment calls where he or she, as the potential arresting officer, would have a little bit of discretion to determine whether or not that particular item was indeed necessary to preserve. For example, if you had an airplane that flew in a bunch of fishermen, and the pilot may have flown off, and meanwhile a fishing game person comes along and finds out that one or two of the people fishing at the lake don't have a fishing license, and the plane comes back to pick up this party, is that necessary to, you know, apprehend that airplane as well? And we were trying to address major items that could be confiscated from the public, which might be tied in with livelihood, and such as aircraft, boats, and not necessarily these smaller items, such as a fishing rod or even a rifle. Well, it probably could depend upon the type of net that we're referring to here, whether it's a personal subsistence net, which might be small as compared to a purse net or a gill net. But that was our intent, Mr. Chairman, to give a little bit more latitude on the part of the arresting officer, and at the same time, if the arresting officer did have a strong case, that what they could do is simply, when that 7-day period came, they could go to a court, and any court that would understand what was happening, the basis of it, would simply give a continuation of holding that particular material for the courts. Now, what has happened here is a series of things that makes it very cumbersome, and we're dealing with small items, everything from a BB gun to a fishing rod to a little box of fishing tackle, and I think it's gone way beyond what we intended. Don't need name tags for those. But that was our intent, Mr. Chairman, and I think that it has gone way beyond the original intent. intention of the prime sponsor, and I wish that Representative Bettis was here to give this committee his particular views on it.
Yes, question, Mr. Ward.
Yes.
Representative Rittner, under your interpretation of the resource committee, if some fish and game guys snuck up the Vena kind and stole caribou, did they have 7 days to give it back or file charges?
Went up to where now?
up somewhere and took caribou meat. Took meat and said it was illegal. Seized it. Would they seize it? Under yours, do they have 7 days to file? Under yours, would fish and game then be under the 7 day rule? The stuff itself, along with the accessory?
No, the meat, of course, would have to be held until the, that's what the violation would be based on. It has to be held until the,
who's got the food? Who?
The people of Venati.
and they've had it well over 7 days. Twice they've done it now. Now, does this also protect the, they seized it?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward and I will have to get together and discuss this. I'll take it.
Is there any further questions? Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Grusendorf, you're the sponsor. You've seen many changes between the two, from resources to the changes that they made. And you're just, as co-sponsor of this piece of legislation, what's your pleasure, sir?
Mr. Chairman, my pleasure would be to hold this bill over until the prime sponsor can address this committee as to what his concerns are. I am not happy with the Judiciary Committee substitute, but for all I know, the prime sponsor has worked.
Very good. At your request, Representative Grusendorf, House Bill number 94 is pulled in finance. That concludes the agenda today. I would like members to know the only thing we're going to try to take up in finance from now on is priority bills, the list of 40 that's on either the House or Senate. That's all I'll be taking up. But I did have a few requests. We'll be taking a few that's not on the priority list next week, but we're getting down to the end. We've got this is T-minus 28 days, Representative Duncan, today, so I just want you to know. Oh, T-minus 28 days.
What's your birthday now?
18th of June.
Mr. Chairman, one question.
Yes.
Does that mean that we will be able to close out finance next week then, with just those 40 bills that we have to worry about?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
We've got bills coming up from the other committees that's slow.
It depends if we don't do any Senate bills.
How's finance adjourned? Would the House Finance please come to order? This afternoon we're going to take up the consideration of confirmation of Bob Heath as Commissioner of Revenue, take up then SB 92, repealing the appropriation to the Permanent Fund, House Bill 301, the special appropriation to pay the 1983 Permanent Fund dividends. I'm going to hold that in committee for a couple more days. Then the last bill we'll hear is House Bill 148. Before I go into confirmation, I see Representative Locker is here, and I'll take you on first since I didn't see that. Representative Locker?
I think, Mr. Chairman, that the wording takes you on. And here's the advice. I came for House Bill 148.
Fine.
And so I'll just come back if you can tell
no,
me.
No, I'll take you on first.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, okay. I'd like to say that when I first introduced House Bill 148, we didn't have too many supporters. I hope we have enough now to see this bill, at least through this committee and maybe through the House. But it did sit in Community and Regional Affairs Committee for several weeks while we worked on the bill. And before it left, everyone there was in support of the concept. And in support of the state getting involved in the preservation of farmland. So I only hope that will win a few of you here today. I would like to say that I come from a community where 1,000 acres of prime farmland is in jeopardy annually and is subdivided for homes. This same community has many, many acres of land that is not suitable to farmland that could just as easily be subdivided. And with this legislation, we would hope that in addition to spending the many millions of dollars that the state of Alaska spends to encourage agriculture in this state and to encourage the production of the food for not only this state but maybe other states, that we do more than just invest this money to develop new land, that we invest some of this money to retain some of the farms that have been in production many, many years that will not be here in the very near future unless we protect them. This bill has a very low fiscal note because there is no money appropriated to purchase the farmland. It would be my choice in the future if it was the only way, as representative from the Matsu Borough, to actually provide some funding, even possibly our capital funding, in order to retain some of these farmlands. It's a very important piece of legislation. The borough has requested it. It's one of their top priorities. And most recently, a task force that was appointed by the governor has come in with a report that that is one thing necessary to encourage agriculture as an industry in the state. So it was part of the Matsu Borough's plan, and we're hoping to see it part of the administration's plan.
The fiscal note that we have is the latest one, which 53083 has an error in it for about $12,000 in it, and I'd like that figure removed and go with the original cost of it, which was 77.3, and the Department of Natural Resources is going to send over a new fiscal note so everybody knows that the fiscal note is 77.3. Is that your understanding?
That's what we have. Mm-hmm.
Very good. So any questions of the sponsor? Representative Bettisworth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This 1,000 acres of agricultural land in is that currently under agricultural production?
Yes, it is, and that's part of this legislation, that it must be currently under production and that it must also be in jeopardy of being subdivided. At least those would be the first parcels that could be purchased or be nominated for purchase.
Okay, thank you. Representative Martin?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions. One, it seems to me that you're worried in Matsu about 1,000 acres or so, and yet we're given hundreds of thousands away up in Tananong and Nana and Old Toke and all over the place. So as far as the emotions that are being expressed, I can't quite feel them yet. We do need expanding room out in the middle part of the state. People are looking very desperately for home sites. And even though Matsu used to be our farming land, it seemed like that wasn't really available for people to have some homestead either. I'm more concerned right now about the fiscal implications of this. It was handed down by the Attorney General a few years ago that land is money and that the appropriations here are very small compared to what you're saying here. If a person rather settle for money, the director does have that obligation, or he can give money in exchange for land. For instance, 1,000 acres of land that's in jeopardy right now, has anyone really given us the true value of it? And what will it cost the state if we have to buy it?
First of all, until funds are appropriated, there would be no funds to actually purchase the land. So what we would be doing with this original legislation is setting up within the department the ability to do this. But yes, many millions of dollars may be required to purchase all ag land that could be in jeopardy. We don't expect to do this the first year nor the fifth year, but just on a systematic basis, appropriate a certain sum of money, and that money go towards purchasing the land that is under the most jeopardy, the one that we would lose next year or the year after. This land would always be... the request for the state to look at their land would always come from the farmer. We would not be going out as a state and looking for all the farmland to purchase. And you're quite correct. We are giving away, if you will, ag rights to many thousands of acres in other parts of Alaska, but this land has never been cleared. After we do that, then we subsidize greatly the farmers in both loan programs and in many other ways, build the roads and everything in order to provide for the development of this land. And while we're doing that, we are subdividing land, right, the best farmland in this state that is proven farmland, and allowing it to go and become subdivided. And I just need to remind you that there are many other states in the union that did not learn this lesson early. There are some of them now doing exactly what we're doing, Washington and Oregon and some of the others. However, California has lost most of its beautiful agricultural land in areas now that are all covered with blacktop and pavement. And I just think that if the state definitely is in favor of agriculture, that this is another area they should be looking at.
With that answer, then, what I'm worrying about is that the state is going to outbid private enterprise. And as you say, millions and millions of dollars may be involved when the people got the land free in the first place to try to develop agriculture in the state of Alaska. For one reason or other, it's not profitable, whatever reason. In many places within the society, the land is now available for home sites. It seems to me that, in just briefly reading this law, that the state may take this, and the department may take this, and use it as a vehicle to prohibit or at least delay the individual from selling as he or she wishes.
And then always be offering a higher price. I really think that we're going to end up with tremendous litigation when we try to prevent free enterprise from working, and that the state will, one way or the other, be enforcing itself upon that individual and offering a tremendous price for it, probably an outrageous price, just to get the land. Or at least he can bid accordingly. Say, look, private enterprise offered me this much, state if you want it, pay the bill.
Right, that is not how this legislation is written, and we spent many weeks on it. The legislation is written so that I, Barb Locker Farmer, could say, I intend to sell my land, and I intend to sell it to a developer. However, I would prefer to continue to farm it or have my children farm it. So I would contact the state. They would come in and have an assessment done or an appraisal done, and they would say that full value of this land is X number of dollars and ag value is X number. They would pay me the balance if I agreed. And from then on, my land could only be farmed forever unless the state changed that at a later date. And if they did, then they would have to buy my ag rights. They have just purchased my development rights. Me and my children could always farm it. I suspect that, yes, if Terry Martin wanted to buy that land, I could say to you, I'm sorry, the state is willing to give me X number of dollars. And however, it is an appraisal. There's no bidding process involved. And you're not willing to match that price. I guess you could construe that to mean that you had been aced out. You're quite right. But in the meanwhile, we will have salvaged that farmland and kept it in production. And that's our objective. But our objective is not for the state to go around overbidding individuals at all. They're only to pay the full market value minus the ag right value.
Representative Bestwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barbara, have you done an analysis of what the theoretical difference between development rights and ag rates might be? And is that cheaper than developing new land, considering it's in the heart of rapidly developing area?
We asked DNR to do that, and they were unable to do it because so much of the money that is invested at this time is in loans that are paid back, and someone needs to work out the subsidy, if you will, the subsidy at lending money at 3 or 4% when you could be getting 12 on the open market, and a whole lot of other things. And so they were unable to do that. No, we did not. We started out knowing full well that there is productive farmland in jeopardy, and what do we do about it? I don't believe that
whether we save money doing it this way is the most important thing. I think the most important thing is that if we even come close, the land right now is being farmed. It's not maybe going to be farmed, maybe going to be productive. It is being farmed right now and has been for several years, and it's in jeopardy. And so unless it would cost you far more to do that than what you're investing, we haven't got that far, and frankly, we didn't have the resources.
I know what it costs to bring new land into production, and but I'm not familiar with land development, land prices in the
right now, the borough has, as part of their code, all class 2, 3, and some 4 soil is always retained for ag land, and we only sell the ag rights. And so that
borough land,
that's right, will never be anything but farmland, but it's raw. And it does. We usually arrange for the farmers to get at least half back in what they pay for that land if they develop according to schedule and they have to file a farm plan. So we are definitely behind agriculture. And we have seen this, and so has our planning commission and our ag committee, as a step that has to be taken in that community.
Representative Ward?
Yes. If I understand, Representative Walker, the state buys this if it's so everybody agrees, and then there's some language in here for counteroffers and rejections and stuff like that. Anyway, all that comes to pass, and then the state puts out money and owns it, and if the people mess up, it pays back to the municipality? Am I reading this correct?
I don't understand your question.
All right, I'll rephrase it. The state buys it, and in case a easement, a youth preservation easement, agricultural preservation easement is defaulted on, the an 8% effect penalty goes in the clause and is paid to the municipality. Am I reading this correctly?
I don't understand your question, Representative.
All right, I'll restate it.
Rather than just taking a sentence out of there, if you'll just ask me the question, I think...
State buys it, makes preservation easement, it's not utilized for farming. There's a penalty assessed on page 9. Where does that penalty go?
I did not realize that there was a penalty for non-utilization. Now, you're not talking about actually breaking...
The actual breaking of the contract,
you are not allowed to develop that land. You are not allowed to put houses on it or anything else. Or yes, that breaks the contract and the property reverts.
Non-farm purposes, which, you know, I have a real question in my mind what a non-farm purpose is. So that's the reason why I'm bringing that
page
up.
Page 9, line what?
Well, that it says... Line 3 is where it's as if subdivided for use for some other non-farm purpose. Now, to me, that's broad enough to where I think a good regulator or regulation writer could catch almost anybody. And then it goes into...
Okay, I think what you're talking about now is clarification of language that's used, okay? So what we're talking about, farm use, land that is included in a farm unit and not dedicated or being used for non-farm purposes and not subject to agricultural preservation easement shall be assessed on the basis of full and true value for farm use, shall not be assessed as is subdivided or used for some other non-farm purposes. The assessor shall maintain records valuing the farm use land for both full and true value and farm use value. Should the farm use land be sold, leased, or otherwise disposed of for uses incompatible with farm use or to be converted to a use incompatible with farm use by the owner, the owner is liable to pay an amount equal to the additional tax of the current mill levy together with 8% interest for the preceding 7 years as though the land had not been assessed for farm use purposes. This has only to do with assessing. It has to do with farm deferral now. When you have a farm, you don't pay the full tax. If at within this certain frame you would sell that land for anything other than farm, it gives the state an opportunity to come back and get the taxes that they have been paying on your behalf. in order to help retain that as farmland. That has nothing to do with the land that's been sold.
Yeah,
the ag rights have been sold.
All right, I think I need to understand something better. Is it your intention in this legislation, we talk about appraisals in here, and then we're there's going to be an appraisal done, which has to be a licensed appraiser in the state of Alaska. But then the appraiser, that does not have to be accepted by the commissioner. They can make their own offer. Is that correct?
I don't remember that.
And then
could
of course.
Could you give me the page? It doesn't have to be accepted by either party, if I remember correctly.
Well, then there's
it's been a long time.
Then there's a rejection period where the owner has 30 days to accept it.
Or reject it. That's
or
correct.
Reject it.
But please be advised that there is no requirement that that farmer sell that land. It is definitely his right to refuse. In other words, we're not zoning this guy into being forced to sell here.
Is your intention for the state of Alaska to pay full appraised value for these farms?
No. The difference between full appraised and farmland, which would be the development right, only that difference. Yes.
Which
if it's $1,000 an acre and you're selling ag land, or the ag rights would be worth $300, the state would pay $700.
This applies to which lands? Is it
applied
to Point McKenzie?
No. Point McKenzie is ag only. All state land, well, I shouldn't say all state land, but most recently all state land that is sold for farmland, only the ag rights was transferred, not the development rights. So that land would never qualify for this. They cannot develop that land. In other words, Jerry, these people have fee simple land. They got it as colonists, or they bought it from other farmers or other people. They have fee simple land. They could subdivide it tomorrow, get their plat through, and sell it built on. And we don't want them to do that. We want them to have an option to continue to farm or to sell us the development rights, and we'll find someone else to farm. Then they could sell farmer to farmer their ag rights, just like they would now with Point McKenzie land. They only have ag rights to sell, and those things sell for, well, the raw land, $200 to $300, and then once it's developed, sometimes $700 or $800. But I've heard farmers say that it takes 6 to 10 years or longer just to get a decent crop off any land. I think Mr. Zaroff probably knows more than I do about that. But there is property in Kodiak that's in jeopardy, that's already been gone. There's property in our area in Fairbanks. But the Point McKenzie land and the land up in Delta should never be in jeopardy because we didn't give fee simple title to it.
I'm not so sure I'm convinced because,
it takes a while.
I live on a farm right now, which is now a subdivision. And if the population here, it's got to go somewhere. And so I don't know what we're really trying to accomplish here, because where are the people going to build their houses?
Not on farms, we hope.
Further questions, Representative Ward?
No, no,
President Lindahl?
Several questions, Mr. Chairman. Representative Walker, where did this bill come from? Is this a bill by request of your constituents, or is this a staff bill? Or
it's a bill that was drafted by the Mattoo Borough Agricultural Committee. It is certainly not the first one of its kind. There have been other states that have passed such legislation, and I believe there was one in this legislature just a few years ago that belonged to me.
Is that a public body, or is that a farmers committee?
It's a public body made up of private people involved in agriculture. State conservation and farmers and loggers.
Let me see if I understand this correctly, this bill authorizes the director to purchase agricultural preservation easement. Obviously, it means money because down on line 29, it says the director may pay money to an owner of land, and then money amount paid. So let's just say I'm Representative Ward, and I have 120 acres out there that I'm growing chickens on, and a bunch of kids who like to dance and stuff like that, and I can divide that into 240 half-acre plots, $10,000 a piece, or $20,000 a piece for a good lot out in the country. That's $4.8 million, which agricultural values may be $300,000. So I'm Jerry Ward, and I now come to you, and I say I would like $4.5 million from the state of Alaska. Is that right?
No, that's incorrect. That is incorrect. First of all, chickens wouldn't work. It has to be under production.
He's got it in
a percentage of it must be under production.
He's growing hay.
Okay, that's good.
He's growing
hay. So then what you do is you come to the state of Alaska and you say, I'd like to sell my development rights for $4.5 million, and if in fact there are funds available, we start going, we first look to see if your property qualifies. Number one, is it under jeopardy? Is it look like it's going to be subdivided in the next year? So you've told us that, but we start following up. Then we hire an appraiser that decides the price, and he gives us two prices.
Okay, well, I understand all that, but
okay.
Let me ask you another question.
Well, that's
okay.
Different than what you
10 years now passed. I've taken my $4.5 million. I have saved agriculture in the state, 120 acres. I've got $4.5 million. It's having a very good time. 20 years passes, inflation occurs, the population grows. My land is now worth, for development rights, it's now worth $40,000 for every half-acre thing. It's now worth $9.6 million. I've only gotten 4.5. Am I going to be back in and see you for another 4.1
million? You're out of luck. You're out of luck. That part belongs to the state of Alaska. Now, the part, the ag rights may have increased in value. Those still belong to you, but only those. And that's all you've got to sell. And there is no developer that's going to buy those. It's going to have to be another farmer, because that's all the value that land has.
So basically what this does is it's a way to justify paying cash payment to farmers.
No, I do not believe that. What it does is it ensures that there will not be development of ag land for anything other than an agricultural industry.
Now that's called zoning. That's called zoning.
Zoning
this is
a rip-off
money.
For the farmer. This is not. And we're hoping he doesn't have a good time on the $4.5 million, although he has a right to do that. We're hoping that then he will have money to develop his farm to the fullest.
What is the difference between what you're doing for $4.5 million and what zoning does?
Zoning doesn't pay the man anything. Where I come from and many other places, a farmer lives from hand to mouth until such time as he sells, and then he becomes a rich, retired farmer.
So the guy gets retired a little earlier?
Not retire him, no. But to give him the investment in his land that we do not want him to retain, that we want to retain his estate. Carry that a step further. There is nothing the matter with his estate at a later time when that farmer wants out completely.
Selling to
another farmer, or in that case, purchasing just those ag rights, and the land belongs to you, and too simple. The state should do with it what they wish, but you have retained it. I would hope forever.
What is the socially desirable thing that we're going to get here for our money? If we do not develop on my example, Representative Ward's 120 acres, we don't put 240 half-acre sites there. No, that's 120 acres.
160.
Well, I started out with 120. We got 150. It's already making what, 5.6 million. Okay. What are we? Those people are going to go to another parcel, right? So effectively, those people now will be less supply of land, so the price of land will go up. That's going to make housing more expensive. So in order to make housing more expensive, we're going to raise property taxes. We're going to pay $4.6 million to him. And I assume that will also reduce his property taxes, right? His assessed value can now only be based on appraised value.
Wrong. Well, right now, he's not paying the taxes on the full value of that land. You are. The state is.
Well, I don't see how cutting the value of his land is going to cause him to pay taxes. Can you explain that?
Okay. First of all, he doesn't pay the difference between the 300 and the 1,000, right? We pay it as a state. Through the municipality.
Are states going to start paying taxes on top of this $4.5 million?
Now. A farmer goes to his assessor and he fills out a form. He applies for a farm deferral. If the land is assessed at $1,000 an acre and it's the assessor's judgment that it is only worth $300 in agriculture, the $700 worth of mill levy is paid for by the state to the municipality on his behalf right now. And that's our contribution towards keeping that land in agriculture. What I'm saying is it's not enough anymore. Because that guy is being hounded by developers.
You don't think $120,000 having a decent place to live is equally valuable to this guy getting $4.5 million?
I definitely think that 120 families having a decent place to live is very valuable. And maybe even equally valuable. What I'm saying to you is that there is a lot of land where these farms are. A lot of land. So there's not a shortage.
Then why do we have to pay them to keep this land in production? If there's lots of land, they should just go get over here and grow it up.
Because you don't develop a farm like you subdivide and build a house. It takes years and years and years to develop.
$4.5 million.
Well, $4.5 million is your
figure. No, I'm just trying to get the average lot prices. I think that's probably a realistic number. Anybody who has 150 acres that's about to be subdivided along your line is going to have about $4.5 million.
That's
buys
after
a lot of
land. That's after a lot of money has gone into it for roads and other subdivision costs. We're talking about it before it's cut up. And quite often the difference may possibly be 700 to 2,000 acres, but that would be the maximum.
Would the Mattoo Borough Assembly vote in favor of this bill? Would they recommend this bill?
They did, and they have, and it's a matter of record.
Mattoo Assembly?
Absolutely. And the Planning Commission and the Governor's Task Force, right?
I'm sure the farmers. I mean, if I was a farmer, I would certainly take the money. There's no doubt about that. In fact, I may go into the not having a farm business at this time. That's all.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Walker, I've been looking at your definitions here and throughout the bill. For example, you talk about agricultural operations. Is animals useful to humans? In your definition of animal, would that include chickens, turkeys, geese, ducks? Or have we left something else out here? For example, we have chicken ranches, turkey ranches, on and on and on. And I was looking in the statutes here, and they make reference here to dogs who have a tendency to bite animals or fowl. Do you think perhaps when was this ever discussed, the possibility of chicken ranches, turkey ranches? I'm curious.
I know you are, and I'm trying to think of it. There's no question in our mind that you could have any kind of ranch you want. However, the land, a percentage of the land must be under production. That is our requirement, and not just have animals running on it. It can't be all grazing land, and it can't. There must be a percentage of it under production.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what my thought here is, we have here agricultural operations, and then you said domestic plants or animals useful to humans. And what I was asking you, whether or not that definition would be broad enough to include fowl, because I notice in the statutes here there's reference to fowl, and I certainly wouldn't want to preclude anyone and would like to make an amendment to your definition so that there would be no problems involved in it should somebody have an agricultural operation in which they wanted to do that type of ranching or farming of what you and I just wondered if it came up in testimony.
It did not, and that would be fine with me. However, we would always want to retain the percentage of land that had to be under production.
Chairman, I would be making that amendment when we were through here.
Representative Ward? I need to understand one thing here. If I had a farm in Wasilla and it was deemed appropriate by the Matanuska Susitna Borough, the Matanuska Ag Council, that this was should be a part of this, and it was on the highways, and it's unzoned. And they said this really should remain a farm so the people could see farms when they drive by here, which I have a feeling they're talking about this specific piece of ground somehow. My ground, now, if I don't want to sell that to them, period, do you think I could run into a little bit of trouble with the Zoning Commission getting my subdivision papers through?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. First, you must be the person that brings your land to them. We already have planning and zoning powers. If we wish to ensure the fact that you would always be forced to farm or at least never be able to develop, we would do that. We don't want to do that. We would like to ensure that farm stay there, but we know that you must be compensated for the value. And so that's why we're not just zoning you out of business, if you will. And we always have those powers, Jerry, and you're not giving us any more. In fact, what we've got here is an option.
No, I understand that fully. I'm just, you know, I'm just having a hard time, maybe in my mind, is why we as a state are getting involved in controlling growth in a populated area. Whether it be bad or good, I haven't made up my mind yet, because I like the idea of farmland, and I think it's a great thing. But there's not a city in the whole western states that wasn't farmland at one time. Now it's condominium and shopping centers, and Wasilla is the same way. Palmer probably won't be, but the rest of it will be. So I'm just curious. So in your mind, you think that this is the proper role for the state to be involved in?
Absolutely. If beans were involved in the development of agriculture, this is just, it goes like bacon and eggs. If you're on top of it. It just goes together. And if we were not involved in the development of agriculture, then I could see you saying, why are we even getting involved? The thing is, we are spending millions and millions of dollars to develop it. And we have plans to even spend more. And how can we justify that when the very best farmland in the entire state is full of ticky-tacky little houses all in a row? And we're allowing it to happen.
The best farmland is at Nenana.
No.
Further questions, Representative Ward?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Representative Martin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't claim to be a farmer because I haven't solved the problem yet, what came first, the chicken or the egg, so now you know my ignorance. I would like to know, though, how many farmers within the Matsu area now are taking advantage of the federal program not to grow various crops, wheat, barley, whatever. What percentage of the farmers have their land not producing because of the monies there available?
I do not know, but I don't believe any.
Alaska farmers aren't eligible for the Farm Bank program.
This is available, this law will make it available throughout the state, any farmland. Like they have some farmland down here in Juneau Town, and so that individual can sell too. Where it was claimed that way, it still is. And it seems to me to be open-minded about it is that since you alluded to the possibility where major areas and municipal government and boroughs and all can leave this land just laid fertile as long as they continue making state money off of it. And to be cynical, it seems to me it would be within the best interest of any growing area where there is farmland, try to preserve that performance, and as you say, they'll get paid the difference in share revenues regardless. So you'll be getting state money, good state money every year for no providing of services. So I'm looking at a cynical way. Why should Matsu do this? Why should we have people come into our area when let's close the door behind us and even get the state to pay for the lands and everything else?
Well, I think you've lost me. But I think what you're saying is that there's a possibility in your mind that the Matsu Borough Assembly and Planning Commission would be looking for a way to lock up their valley.
Sure.
Is that what you said?
Why not? If you get the share of revenues in the same place of Anchorage, heavily populated and all, where you say, let those suckers stay there, you know,
And if we only get so much per square mile or whatever the acres are used, and you get the same amount, but yet you aren't going to let any people be there.
Well, in response to that, number one, we get those shared revenues on a per capita basis.
No,
and number two, we're a very large borough. We have many, many thousands of acres. And I suppose that if we really wanted to lock it up, what we would do is just not approve subdivision plats, because those are the plats that people buy that require the services. You're right, the schools and all those other things. I just don't know, Representative Martin, how you could ever get that out of this farm bill. We approve plats regularly. We're the fastest growing community in this entire state. The city of Wasilla is the fastest growing city, I understand, in the nation. I don't think we're locking people out, and I wouldn't want anyone to think that we were with this legislation.
Well, why not stop platting?
Why not stop platting?
Yeah.
It would not seem the thing for a good Republican to ever advocate to stop someone from getting full and true value from their land. I believe in private property rights, and they're all worth money.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Locker, I would like you to think about whether you believe your bill is in the state's financial interest, if it's in our best interest, and if we can afford it. If you go back down to Idaho or Nebraska or Kansas or the Dakotas, you find basically a recession, and some would call it a depression. The price of the grain is so bad, you had to have International Harvest to go through a corporate reorganization, and they almost went bankrupt. And I think old McCormick invented the reaper, and that's the essence of our agricultural tradition. So you've got the grain elevators full down there with no market and a bad price. Now, your fiscal note calls for $77,000 to administer it, but to implement this program is going to cost billions. Now, certainly I could be incorrect in what I say. I would ask you, do you think this bill is in the state's financial best interest?
Absolutely. I wish I had the money to purchase all the development rights of this beautiful farmland and could retain them for future generations. I personally, let alone the state of Alaska. And I do not believe by the longest stretch of imagination that it would ever cost billions to insure this. It would not.
To buy these rights?
To buy these rights. And we do have that. I don't have it in front of me. But we know exactly what it would cost, and it's not anywhere near that. And then thirdly, I'd like to say to you that it's nice to be from the country that has the grain elevators full rather than the one that has to beg in order to buy. And it's our responsibility. We are so far away from any market where we buy our food that we at least have areas where we could grow our food if necessary, and we should be encouraging this market so that we could become self-sufficient, at least for ourselves, at least in vegetables and grain. And we just allowed money for, what, 3 red meat plants. We're encouraging agriculture everywhere else, but when it comes to hanging on to some of these farmland.
Chairman, I would just ask you a final question. It's a little prejudicial, but it seems like the logical conclusion of your bill is that you're asking us to join Nebraska and Idaho Association.
I don't know how you could ever say a thing like that again. Tell me what you put behind it.
Price of grain and marketing?
Price of grain and marketing? You are thinking that if Alaska joins the grain market and doesn't continue to purchase from these areas, that we would somehow hurt them worse? I would say it would ensure that Alaska's agriculture would have future. Let Nevada and these other places take care of themselves, and Nebraska, or wherever I
live. Red Basket of America.
Yeah. I guess I'd like to say to you that that there are a lot of laws in place to protect agriculture in other states, and this is just one that I think the state of Alaska needs to use it right now.
Representative Ward?
Yes.
Representative Walker, under this page 4 paragraph, last paragraph, about the removal of subsurface rights for 5 years, explain to me why that's there. And then in the same thing, I guess, why do you have that in there? Removal of
subsurface for 5 years.
Which page is it?
Page 6.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Line 24.
I do know that we were concerned about a farmer needing the gravel off his own land to build his road. But we did not want him to have a gravel pit. And so we gave him a time frame. But he got the gravel out and he built his farm road. And then he put it back. And I'm sure that that's the paragraph. I haven't found it yet.
Page 6, line 24. So what you're referring to is gravel. You're not referring to if the guy finds the gold nugget.
We didn't even talk about it.
Okay, you should, because the state of Alaska owns too much subsurface. The state of Alaska shouldn't be owning all the subsurface. These guys accidentally, what everybody should own, too simple. They should own their subsurface, but now we're taking back the chances of anybody even owning their subsurface again within this legislation. So I got to. Subsurface takes in a whole stuff besides gravel.
Okay, so we don't very often go out mining those areas. You know, they're right outside of cities. They're going to be subdivided and they're in farmland and have been for many, many years. Now, normally you don't mine those areas, but you quite often have a gravel pit on them and you need to build roads on the farm. So we address that. We didn't think about the fact that there could be a gold mine under one of them. We really did not.
Is there anything within the charter of the Matsu Borough right now that would stop and forbid the Matsu Borough from exchanging property and our money to one of these farms right now? For them to do that?
No, we can't.
Okay, then in case there's that this legislation runs into a problem, there's nothing that prohibits the Matsu from taking the position of the state at present time and doing this themselves. Is that not correct?
Absolutely not.
Have they done this in the past?
No, we do not have the money. We would have to sell bonds. Other communities have done this in the lower 48, sold bonds to purchase this land.
Okay. What I'm asking now is the Matsu also owns property that is not farmland, that is developable. Have they approached any of their priority farmers and asked them to exchange 40 acres for 320 acres of on-highway developable? Have they gone through the effort of trying to preserve some of these through a land exchange program?